there was a lot of local activism that I wanted to do. And when I would say, I think I'll need to bring my kids to this meeting, the response would be, oh, why?
Welcome to Radio Free School.
I'm Colleen Murphy, and I live in New Orleans, where I've lived for 4.5 years. I'm an unschooler since I was 11, so it was a big part of my identity before I had my own kids. I publish a calendar every year that's called the Mama Calendar. It came out of the work that I was doing as a volunteer for hipmama.com. I had an idea to put together a calendar kind of for the community. So it was a little more yearbooky than it is, than what it became. Some people that I had met through that encouraged me to keep doing it on my own. So that's how it's been for the past 4 years. It's been something that I do, and it's developed into something that's more, it's more like a zine, and there are a lot of contributors.
So what is the Deep South Mouth then? What is that?
The Deep South Mouth is the zine that I've been putting out since right before I moved to New Orleans. I guess I started it when I was still living in Mississippi. First issue has a lot to do with that, with me being, when I was living in Mississippi, I didn't have any real social connections outside of my family. And so these connections that I had over the internet through Hip Mama and through the Postal Service, through all the people I knew who made zines, became just incredibly important to me. My family lives in Mississippi and have for 10 years now, but it's not where I grew up, and I don't have a support system there or friends there. And so when I moved there, I kind of landed there and lived there for a year and a half with a baby and a toddler and broken up marriage, and it was all just really isolating, just being in this new place. I feel like I'm making it sound like my zine was really deep. It wasn't. But it came out of my need to make something and do something. I have been, ever since the disaster down here in New Orleans, I've been asking myself this question of, well, am I still going to make a zine? And I think what I've come to now, well, I mean, the first question was, am I going to make the calendar? And so I did that, and it happened. It was really hard to do. It was hard to do logistically because I don't have, I mostly rely on friends for childcare, and most of my friends are not here, or like the printer I usually use is gone. They were dealing with a situation where the office that they had for years and years is gone. They're in a new space, and there were just all these logistical barriers, but before I even got to those, I had this kind of emotional barrier where every time I would start to work on it, I would feel like, how can I, you know, in the face of this disaster, how can I be working with all these words and pictures and images that just seemed so trivial? It felt like, how can it be enough to make something pretty? And so that was a really hard thing for me to get through. And I feel good about the way the calendar worked out. And it is more, I hope, that it's a little more of an inspiration for somebody like me who's an activist and a parent and kind of needs affirmation of that. But the zine, I think that eventually I will make a zine again. I don't know if it's going to be the Deep South Mouth. It might be that that's kind of run its course. I've always lived in the South, but living in Mississippi was kind of more intensely experiencing that deep South culture that everybody sees in the media in a way that I never had before. And so that was kind of my focus of what's it like to be here. And now, I don't know, that's just not how it is anymore.
Yeah.
I have less time to do something like make a zine because I've made volunteer work a priority in my neighborhood. And that's something that when I was away, I evacuated for a month. And while I was away, there was a huge question of to go back to New Orleans or not. I felt really strongly that if I was going to come back, I wanted to be part of something happening that was positive. So that there's an anarchist collective that is, fortunately for me, started up in my neighborhood. So I can walk there and I can bring my kids with me.
As a result of the tragedy of the...
Yeah, something that didn't exist before. Yeah, it's pretty amazing. It's called Common Ground, the Common Ground Collective. And kind of where I plug in is that this is a group of people, most of whom have come from all over the country, but the founders are people who are from New Orleans and from this neighborhood. And the original inception came out of being here during the aftermath of the storm and seeing that there were needs and the government was not filling them. I mean, there was also, my neighborhood is Algiers and it's not, it didn't get flooded, for example. So it's not where there was a lot of attention being focused, and yet people over here were also hungry and not having water and, you know, having a lot of wind damage to their homes. But there was also this dynamic of the upper-class white people protecting their homes with arms. And I mean, there were shootings that don't seem to be documented. There's just a lot of word of mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on who you talk to, you hear these widely varied stories about things that went down in the neighborhood during that time. But in the face of that, some people put together Common Ground and as a collective that would be responding to the disaster. And then once the immediate disaster had passed, now Common Ground has moved into a place of, I mean, they're still working with people on disaster issues, like they have a legal team to help people out who are getting illegally evicted. They have a team that goes out and helps people fix their roofs or help scrub mold out of their houses in cases that can be done.
Mm-hmm.
But we're also looking at a long-term free clinic, I mean, hopefully a permanent free clinic here in the neighborhood. That's functioning right now, and it has been since a week after the storm. But we're talking about, so how is this sustainable? Obviously, there was a need, and there still is a need. The people around here just weren't getting, I mean, only the upper-class people had access to good health care. There's also talk of putting together a free school and organizing child care cooperatives. There's a group doing what they call bioremediation, where they work with compost and herbs and pour it into the soil on the other side of the river in the places that were badly flooded. The fact that the majority of the people doing this work have come from elsewhere is, I mean, it's wonderful and it's inspiring, but it's also an obstacle. And I think that's kind of where we are right now, is looking at, and even me as somebody who's only lived here for 4.5 years, a lot of people, especially working class, poor people in New Orleans, have lived in New Orleans for generations. And their perspective on things is just really different from somebody who moved here as an adult.
You are listening to Radio Free School on CFMU.
Now, the activism that your children are being included, they're seeing you just as maybe, I don't know, did you grow up as an activist in an activist family?
Yeah. It's something that when a few years ago I first started hearing people talk about this question of, is homeschooling compatible with feminism? That it was hard for me to get my brain around that question because one of the things that homeschooling did in my childhood, as somebody who stopped going to school when I was 10, is that it meant that now I could do the things with my parents that I was doing anyway, a lot of which was activism, and not be penalized because I'd been missing school. Mainly feminist activism was kind of the focus of what my mother was up to from about midway through my childhood on. And so that, I spent a lot of time going to demonstrations and going to meetings and turning the crank on the mimeograph machine to get newsletters out. And that was really meaningful for me and affected, you know, my sense of what's important. I mean, there were times when the dishes were not done. And that was okay with me, and it's okay with me now. It's, I think my house is probably just as messy as the one I grew up in, and and I don't feel guilty about that.
Talking about doing dishes, I mean, yeah, I don't know if you, was the work shared in your family, or was that important? Is that even nowadays, is in your life now, is that an important aspect of, I mean, is that important for you as a feminist that the work, housework be shared work, or is it something that doesn't really bother you that much?
It's starting to get important to me now because my household is me and my sons who are 6.5 and 8, almost 9, and we have 2 dogs. And so there's a lot of stuff that needs doing just to keep things going. And I've found, you know, about half the time they love to take responsibility for the dogs. And if I can slow down and not be in a big rush, they love to cook. Sometimes they love to do the dishes. Often something like, and this is probably somewhat typical, but something like, okay, let's fold these clothes and put them away. It's just like, what? Why should I have to do that? And then I'm saying, you know, why should I have to do it? But that, I mean, they're at an age where their response to that is, well, so what? It could just not be done, and that would be okay. What ends up happening is that sometimes, oh, I don't know, probably at least half the time, there's a lag time between clothes being totally clean and then actually getting into the drawers, and that especially my older son will get up one morning and say, ah, there's nothing in my drawer. And I'll say, well, nobody put it in your drawer. And he'll have this kind of, well, why didn't anybody do that? Well, I guess I didn't do it because I was doing these other things and I forgot and I hadn't done it yet. You know, why didn't you do it? But that, I'm really resistant to making some kind of a chart or a list. Although maybe they would like that better. I don't know. That's what we had in my family when I was growing up, was a very organized chart. And everybody had the things that there were, you know, were their responsibilities. I would have friends sometimes when I was a teenager who would know my mother really well, and then they would meet my father or kind of observe the household and say, you know, whoa, because to them it looked really patriarchal. But yeah, my father was definitely the breadwinner and kind of came in from a hard day's work and had his dinner. And that, so yeah, his name wasn't on the chart. On the other hand, I mean, my observation about that is that that was what worked for my parents, that they were happy with that. And now, as a couple, I've observed that they seem to kind of informally trade off doing the dishes, at least. I don't know why it's always the dishes, but that's like a book, the book The Women's Room by Marilyn French. There's a moment in it where somebody says, well, I hate discussions of feminism that then get into who does the dishes. And the other person says, well, so do I. But then at the end of the discussion, somebody still needs to do the dishes.
Yeah.
I used to work at a Waldorf school before I had kids. I was at a meeting once where a parent asked a person who was there lecturing, saying, you know, well, how do, you know, the children in their classroom, it's part of their experience in the classroom to do all the cleaning, and they love it. you know, and they're singing and scrubbing and just having a great time. And, well, how do I get them to do that at home? And the speaker was just saying, well, do you do that at home? When's the last time you had a really good time doing the dishes? And that's, I mean, that's something that I try. I often fail. But I try to remember that because Liam, my younger son, does love to do the dishes. And sometimes I just don't have the patience to let him, you know, it takes him a couple hours. But he does want to do them, and he enjoys doing them. And it's kind of one of those things. What's the rush?
The idea of happiness in feminism, the idea of being content as a homeschooling person in the home. You might have a comment on that.
I feel like, for me, it's been, like, when I had a baby and a toddler, it made sense to me to be with them all the time. But one way that I could be happy with that was to have the awareness that it wasn't always going to be that way. I have a need to say to my kids, and it's so nice that now they're old enough that I can say this to them, say, you know, now I've done this and that with you, and I've read with you. Now I'm going to read my own book or go work on my own writing, and
right,
you can do your own thing. I have a job. I work for the Unitarian Church as the religious education director, and a lot of that I do at home. Well, especially now, I do it at home because the office that I had was flooded. And that I miss, I mean, even though it was generally only one day a week that I would go to my office, I really miss that. I miss being able to go into an uninterruptible space. And I think, I'm a single parent, but I'm not a solo parent. You know, they have another parent who is involved and spends time with them. But even that, I feel like, is not enough. I mean, I think my ideal vision of how kids would grow up is with a whole group of adults who were important people in their lives, who live nearby. I mean, I feel like we have that, but not nearby. And that's actually, it's one of the great things about being involved now with Common Ground, for me, is that one of the values that I have in common with most of the people working there is the expectation that sometimes my kids will be with me. More often than not, my kids will be with me, and that most of the people involved talk to them like regular people, you know, and ask them what they're thinking about. One of the herbalists at the clinic actually borrowed a book from Nash, my older son, that she saw him reading at the coffee shop, and they got into a discussion about it. I mean, that's kind of the kind of experience I had growing up that was really positive, having all these adults who treated me with respect. And that's been something that before the disaster was mostly missing from our social group around here. And that there was a lot of local activism that I wanted to do. And when I would say, I think I'll need to bring my kids to this meeting, the response would be, oh, why? When I was a teenager, I felt I would just have a really strong response when people would say things like, well, don't you, you don't go to school, so what about having friends? And I would say, well, I have all of these friends, but they're not my age. I mean, that's what people are really asking.
Mm-hmm.
What about friends who are exactly your age? And that, I mean, to me, that's one of the fundamentals of unschooling, is questioning that whole idea that
right,
you need friends who are exactly your age. And this idea that people, because they're a certain age, would have the same interests. It feels like, I think whether we were back in New Orleans now or not, I think that part of the emotional impact of what has happened in New Orleans, and not just in New Orleans, I mean, that where my parents and my sister and brother live in Mississippi, their homes were flooded and had to be rebuilt. This big area, like, part of the emotional impact is, for me, an increased sense of living the life that I want to live right now. I mean, that's been one of those things that is important to me and has been in my consciousness, but it kind of gets, in the past, it feels like it's on the to-do list somewhere. Like, you know, do the dishes, do the laundry, be happy. That keeps getting moved down. And so it feels really good and right to me to be involved now with the clinic because there's work there that I need to do, but also I feel like it's made our unschooling more what I wanted it to be, that I do a lot less of just talking theory on my own. And that feels really good. I mean, the flip side of that is that the library system in the city is just a shadow of what it used to be. And so we don't have all of these paper resources that we used to have. But I think that we're doing much more of actively living in the world.
There's a river of my people, and its flow is swift and strong, flowing to some mighty ocean, though its course is deep and long. Flowing to some mighty ocean, though its course is deep and long. Many rocks and reefs and mountains seek to bar it from its way, but relentlessly this river seeks its brothers at the sea. But relentlessly this river seeks its brothers at the sea. You will find me in the mainstream, steering surely through the foam, far beyond its raging waters, I can see our certain home. Far beyond its raging waters, I can see our certain home. For I have mapped this river, and I know its mighty force, and the courage that this gives me will hold me to my course. And the courage that this gives me will hold me to my course. O river of my people, together we must go. Hasten onward to that meeting where my brothers wait, I know. Hasten onward to that meeting where my brothers wait, I know.
Listening to Radio Free School on CFMU.
Boom, boom, ain't it great to be crazy? Boom, boom, ain't it great to be crazy? Giddy and foolish all day long. Boom, boom, ain't it great to be crazy?
Scientific method at the vet. The outlook wasn't brilliant for my experiment that day. The only way to graduate was to come up with an A. So when my lab exploded and turned to blackish gunk, my chance of passing anything went Titanic, you know, sunk. I sat and sadly watched the clock, cursed to be alive. It would take a miracle, no, make that two, to get me to grade 5. Then I had a brainstorm, an idea so terrific, I just had to use those words from Method Scientific. I grabbed my pen and got to work. You should see my look. I slowly wrote hypothesis, observation in my book. And now the class bell rings, and now I lose or win with one mighty plop. I hand my lab book in. Well, somewhere in some science class, hypotheses are made, experiments are conducted, kids move up a grade. Somewhere, conclusions are concluded without a bit of doubt. If there is no joy in this lab, my results got me flunked out. You're it. Eeny, meeny, miny, mo. Catch a virus, watch it grow. Once it's got you, it won't go. Eeny, meeny, my, oh no.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm Brown.
And... I'm going to talk about... McMaster, electronic science, we got to see, what's his name again?
DNA.
DNA, and from a kiwi.
You extracted DNA from a kiwi?
Yeah.
Can you describe what you had to do?
We had to have a plastic bag, and then... put the kiwi in the plastic bag and then kind of like make your hand into a fist and mush it up. Like anyway, just like mush it up.
Yeah.
And then when it's really, really mushed up, and then what do you do?
Yeah, to add that solution, right?
And soap and water and salt.
And what was that for? Do you remember what that was for? Wasn't it to break the cell walls?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
yeah.
Then we had these kind of tubes. Got cheesecloth and dump the kiwi into the cheesecloth.
Yeah. To strain it, right?
Yeah, and then it looked kind of like rain throw up because then the seeds are in there.
Then you had to add something else, didn't you? Alcohol, right?
Yeah. Dump it out onto this kind of like
just a little bit of it.
Petri dish.
Yeah, with like we had to dig out of a little tube, but just a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then with a magnifying glass, then we got to see the DNA.
And what did it look like, that DNA?
Little stringy hair.
So is DNA in your body too? In your body cells?
Yeah.
Is it in a piano bench cell?
No. I don't know.
It's not. This piano bench isn't something living.
Right.
It's just some dead wood or whatever.
And then near to the end, we made putty.
Silly putty.
Go past your window last night. I roller skated to your door at daylight. It almost seems like you're avoiding me. I'm okay alone, but you got something I need. Well, I got a brand new pair of roller skates. You got a brand new key. Something for me. Oh, I got a brand new pair of roller skates. You got a brand new key. I ride my bike, I roller skate. Don't drive no car. Don't go too fast, but I go pretty far. For somebody who don't drive, I've been all around the world. Some people say I done all.
The end.
I'm gonna wrap myself in paper. I'm gonna daub myself with glue. Stick some stamps on the top of my head. I'm gonna mail myself to you.
Contact Radio Free School at grassroots@hwcn.org or mail P.O. Box 19, 1280 Main Street West, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, L8S1CO.